of the House Committee on Judiciary to order Monday, May 9th, 2011. We are going to go out of sequence for one bill. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 803. Staff?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Senate Bill 803 comes to us in response to a Court of Appeals decision pertaining to the definition of knowingly possess or control as it pertains to visual depictions of child pornography. Senate Bill 803 would modify the definition of this term alongside knowingly possess in an attempt to capture individuals who access child pornography on the internet but do not download, save, or purchase that pornography.
Okay, can Senator Mona Sanderson come up, please? I'll let her go first, and then I'll call up the last three together on the bill.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Krieger, Co-Chair Barker, members of the committee. I'm State Senator Lori Mona Sanderson, and I represent Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, and Fairview. I support 803 because it changes our child pornography law, and our current law right now says it is not a crime to view child pornography online as long as the viewer does not purchase or download it. And so this legislation will actually close that loophole and make it a crime to knowingly view child pornography by expanding the statute. Our children are our most precious possessions, and they must be protected. And under no circumstances should the sexual exploitation of innocent children be tolerated. I believe that child sexual exploitation can be one of the worst crimes imaginable. And I want to make it easier for prosecutors to pursue and convict cases of child pornography. Exploiting our children is one of the most heinous ways, and it's so intolerable. And we need to be absolutely clear right here in this state that viewing child pornography on the web is wrong and illegal. And we will have to, I want to discourage this activity in any way and every way. And this bill helps us get there. Thank you.
Questions? Going to let you go.
Thank you very much. Good bill.
Representative, were you here on this bill or another one? Which one were you here on? Oh, you're just coming by to see how it's done.
I heard that. You can get it right, though,
will you? We will. Okay, I have Kevin Campbell, John Kroger, and I'm going to use the initials JR because it's easier.
Mr. Chairman, I'm John Kroger. I'm the Attorney General of Oregon, and I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 803. This bill is identical in its text to House Bill 3323, which was previously passed out by the committee and passed by the House. It is a response to the Oregon Supreme Court's decision, which held that merely accessing child pornography on the internet is not illegal under Oregon state law. The problem here, if the committee will recall, is that Oregon's child pornography statute was never really updated for the internet age. It defined the crime in terms of simple possession, and there was a legal debate about whether accessing child pornography on the internet was to possess it. The Supreme Court ruled that absent the decision to download it, print it, or purchase it, one did not possess child pornography simply by accessing it on the web, leaving Oregon, as far as we know, is the only state in the country right now where viewing child pornography on the internet is not a crime. The bill would fix that loophole and has three safeguards to make sure that people who do not intentionally access this material are not somehow caught up if somehow child pornography were downloaded by someone else or by some kind of spyware on the computer. It requires for the government to obtain a conviction for the defendant to knowingly access the material. It's got to be accessing it with the intent to view the material, and it has to be for the purpose of arousing or satisfying the sexual desires of the defendant. So it would be a defense, for example, if the person looked at the material because they had no idea what a website was that somehow was their computer had downloaded, and they wanted to see what it was, and then it turned out to be something that was illegal. They could not be prosecuted. So the bill has three good protections to make sure that someone isn't inadvertently caught up on this, so that we're only prosecuting those people who are intentionally accessing this material.
Okay. Co-chairs and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. Nothing really needs to be added. I'm here to go on the record in support of this bill. I think it's an important change, and the police departments around the state support it.
Okay. Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is J.R. Ujifusa. I'm a deputy district attorney for Multnomah County, and I'm representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. And I would echo the sentiments made earlier and would also let the committee know that I support this bill, that the Oregon District Attorney's Office Association supports this bill as well. And I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
John, is there any difference in this House and Senate bills, do you know?
Our staff checked with Legislative Council, and they're identical.
Of course, we should move the House bill, shouldn't we?
I have no opinion on the correct vehicle to move, but I appreciate the committee's leadership in taking this matter up.
I'm just sure that there is a great interest in both houses for this. Yeah. Committee, you have any questions or comments? Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 803. Go back up to 425 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 425. And we have a long sheet. I want to make people aware. We got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. We got 8 people need to testify. So try to keep your comments within about a 4 to 5 minute period if you possibly can per person. Is Roger Martin here yet?
Mr. Chairman, as the committee, Senate Bill 425 comes to you from the Interim Judiciary Committee. Does 3 things: removes a requirement that the state prove that a person charged with compelling a minor to engage in prostitution knew the person being compelled was a minor, and eliminates offense that the defendant did not know the minor's age or the defendant reasonably believed the minor was older than 18 years of age. Applies to conduct occurring after the effective date of the measure, adds, aids, or facilitates the crime of compelling prostitution, subject to juvenile age 15 or 16 years of age, to juvenile court jurisdiction rather than adult court, and mandatory minimum sentence of 70 months for facilitating the crime of prostitution, unless the juvenile court waives the child to adult court, declares an emergency effective upon passage.
Roger.
Mr. Chair, co-chairs and members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin, and I'm here representing the Oregon Catholic Conference. That's a group that includes both the diocese and east of the Cascade Mountains, the Baker Diocese and the Portland Diocese. Archbishop Vlasny who heads the diocese, is strongly, strongly in favor of everything we can do to try to stem this problem of teenage prostitution and those that cause it, who are usually pimps and other people who are taking advantage of young people. I won't testify long. I think some of the best testimony you're going to get today is from the students from West Salem High School are here. They were the best speakers on the issue in the Senate. Listen carefully. They've done some really beautiful investigative work on the whole issue, and they're talking about people their age who are being abused. One of the areas that I do want to bring to your attention, Catholic Charities has found that there is a much larger than suspected prostitution situation with foreign nationals who are brought into this country as teenagers to work. They come from countries where they couldn't possibly get a job like they could even in the agricultural community in our state. They come because they think they've got a job. They find out they get sexually exploited. The same thing is true of people brought in to work in restaurants. And amazingly, people that are brought here by officials from other countries as servants in their household, they are sexually abused. They do not speak English. They do not know our laws. They don't know who to talk to or how to go about complaining about it. And Catholic Charities has found a large number of these. We don't have an easy solution to this problem. This bill will help. Other bills will help. But this needs to be an ongoing subject for the Judiciary Committees of both the House and Senate. I would include students such as the ones from West Salem High School who are here to testify to you, because it's a problem that we've got to help solve. I have a personal experience that I would like to relate to you. A decade or so ago, two of my daughters were found using back in the days when we had telephone credit cards, a credit card when we were on a vacation trip, and they were calling their boyfriends back home, and we tried to figure out, what are you doing? You can't be using the phone. Well, we get this free credit card. Well, the free credit card came from a pimp who had befriended one of my daughters, came in from Portland. We lived in Lake Oswego. They'd never mixed with kids from other cultures, so he was charming. He drove a beautiful car, he had gifts, and he had this free credit card. Well, it turned out to be a card stolen from a bus driver by a pimp in Eugene, passed up the line, and the number was being distributed, all in an attempt to get young girls to be involved. Now, thankfully, he got no further than that. We reported it. But part of this problem is trying to get across something that I think these West Salem high schoolers realized. When we confronted all of the kids that had these credit cards in a meeting of parents, they were astounded how horrible we were to be prejudiced against this fine young man they had gotten the card from. It took them about 2 days to realize that they'd been had, or almost been had. Pimps that are in this business are very clever and very tricky. I urge you to pass this bill, but continue on the whole subject into the future.
Committee members, do you have any questions for Mr. Martin? Thank you, Roger.
Thank you.
I want to have Commissioner Diane McKeel come up first, please.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I am Diane McKeel, Multnomah County Commissioner. Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, and members of the committee, I want to begin by thanking you for taking up this bill and the difficult issue that it attempts to address. This bill takes an important step towards imposing real punishment upon people who intentionally victimize children as young as 12 years old for the purposes of sex trafficking. These children are not just victimized once, but over and over again, day after day. We must work together at all levels of government to end this tragedy in our state. At Multnomah County, we are working to hold Johns, or the buyers, accountable and to help victims. We've recently, in January, started a sex buyer accountability and diversion program, also known as a Johns School. The $1,000 fee paid provides funding for law enforcement, treatment, and prosecution. We also, in conjunction with Janus Youth and the City of Portland, have been able to open the first dedicated shelter beds to this population. It's 6 to 8 beds, which is not enough, but it is a start. Safe shelter, we hear consistently, is the biggest gap in this issue. We also have a grant, a commercial sexual exploitation of children grant, a federal grant that organizes nonprofits, providers, government, survivors, all around the same table to take a look at multiple issues. While we are making progress for victims and accountability of the buyers, we need stiffer penalties to go after traffickers. Senate Bill 425 will allow our DAs to prosecute pimps for intentionally targeting children and have them receive the much-needed stiffer penalties that come with that crime. I urge the committee to pass this bill and send the message to pimps and traffickers that in our state, they will be punished for victimization of our children. Thank you.
Any questions?
I just wanted to take a moment, Commissioner McKeel, to thank you. 3 years ago, I did not, like many people, I was not aware of this issue. But during your term of service, you have been an absolute all-star and a saint, raising this issue, letting people know, and fighting it back in our community. And I just wanted to take this opportunity to thank you very much, and I'm certainly with you.
Thank you.
Anything further?
Well, I would like to speak, if I may, after your question.
Oh, certainly may.
Thank you.
And I would like to thank again, repeat what Representative Juan said. I know, Commissioner, you've been working on this for quite some time and really putting a lot of work in and getting it recognized by people who drive down the street and don't ever see what's going on. And it's been very helpful, and I really appreciate your work on that. Thank you.
Thank you. We've had a lot of partners in this effort, and I appreciate all of your partnership as well. It does take all of us to do this, so thank you.
Anything further? Okay, thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you. Thanks. Co-chairs, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify on Senate Bill 425 today, which is regarding compelling prostitution. For the record, I'm Carolyn Tomei, State Representative from House District 41. We've heard about this issue before. We had a House bill that came before this committee that dealt with the Johns that Commissioner McKeel was just talking about. As you've also heard, Oregon is a hub, especially Portland. The metropolitan area is a hub for sex trafficking. The traffic goes up and down the I-5 corridor from Mexico up to Canada, and they have sort of posses of children, groups of children that they pass through each community. So these children pose very difficult problems. As Commissioner McKeel said, appropriate shelter and treatment is hard to find. These kids often don't see themselves as victims. They see themselves as free agents. And very often, if they're placed in a foster home, they go in the front door and go back out the back door. And they call in their pimps to pick them up. Law enforcement has a hard time getting them to testify against their pimps, and it's a very, very difficult situation. So we heard House Bill 2714, and I think that passed on the floor of the House and is in the Senate. This bill, 425, deals with the traffickers, thank you, themselves, those people who control these young people. It modifies the crime of compelling prostitution so that it's easier to prosecute those people who traffic in children. This adds to the compelling prostitution statute the phrase aids or facilitates the commission of prostitution by a person under 18 years of age. And it also specifies ignorance of age is no defense. And that's a very important one, because we heard from a woman here last week who was saying her husband had gone to a prostitute. She was under 18, but she said she was over 18, and she looked over 18. We don't want any more to have that as an excuse for prostituting children. I'd like to thank the many advocates. We saw one here, Commissioner McKeel, and others who stepped forward to address this problem. Law enforcement, child welfare workers, treatment providers, religious groups, also the City of Portland, and especially Multnomah County officials for their work with these young victims. And also, I think he isn't here, but City Commissioner Dan Saltzman has also been very active, and so has Senator Bruce Starr. I'm not sure, I haven't seen him here. Also, U.S. Senator Ron Wyden, he's been a strong voice in advocating for federal fund for shelters. This group of shareholders has developed a package of legislation to provide the tools needed to help these children. Regarding the remaining issues surrounding sex trafficking of children, we need to help to find funding to provide the shelter and treatment that these kids need once that they're picked up by law enforcement. And we need to establish effective mechanisms that will get these kids into treatment and keep them there. We'll continue these efforts, and I hope to have more legislation in future sessions. Sex trafficking is a serious problem here in Oregon. It has severe and long-lasting effects on its victims. Washington has taken steps to combat it. California's laws are stricter than ours, and this Senate bill is another step we need to help better protect our children. And I urge your aye vote on this bill. Thank you so much.
Representative Tomei, we've talked about the juveniles. Address a little bit about that young lady who's 18, 19, or 20 that may have started out there. Now she's above that, and is just as degrading and horrible in my mind right. as young people.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right, Co-Chair Krieger. You're absolutely right. This legislation, because that opens up all kinds of different issues. So the legislation that we're promoting this session does not cover those. We heard a lot from these young women, and some not so young, who've been started in prostitution when they were very young. And it is just, it's just a self-fulfilling problem that they're in. Once they're in, and very often they are given drugs, they're given methamphetamine now because it's fairly cheap and it's easily addicted, and so they become addicted to drugs. They often become pregnant, they have children. So yeah, it's a horrible problem, and hopefully in future sessions we'll have a chance to deal with some of those issues.
Committee members, any questions, comments?
I just comment briefly that I think part of the problem is the normal average citizen doesn't really see what's going on at all, and they go to the movie and see Pretty Woman and they think that's what prostitution is, and it is absolutely not. Anybody who's been around it knows that so often it's just some young girl that's been exploited and life really in jeopardy.
Thank you, Co-Chair Barker. You're absolutely right. And very often they say within 48 hours of a kid running away from home. And we're not just talking about in the urban area. We're talking about all over the state. And in some ways, the kids from the rural area are more vulnerable and less street savvy as the local kids. And they're lost, and they need help, and these guys will pick them out and very often. And then they'll take them away from the area, take them out of Portland, so that they don't have anybody that they can refer to that they know. They'll cut off access to their families. So, yeah, it is a very serious problem. Some people say this is a victimless crime. It is not. These are victims, these kids. And that's one of the reasons we wanted to decouple the crime, so that the crime of prostitution, it's the John and the pimp, and that these kids are victims.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And right on that thread, just want to note, indeed, this is a crime involving the victims. We are amending here ORS 137.707, which is commonly known as Measure 11 regarding the presumptive sentences. So this is being added to the Measure 11, if you will, and just to reiterate that these Measure 11 crimes are serious victim crimes.
Yes, yes.
This is a serious victim crime and appropriately there. So.
Thank you for pointing that out. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'd like to have the students come up now, but I'm not certain who are the students. Are two or three of you?
Us two.
Come on up. You must be Carl?
Yes, sir.
All right, come on up and give us your names before you start speaking, please. Go ahead, state your name and go ahead.
Okay. Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Carl Kreitzberg, and I'm a student at West Salem High School, which is located at 1776 Titan Drive Northwest. I support Senate Bill 425 because it is a positive step towards abolishing child prostitution in the state of Oregon. It's my personal opinion that in order to combat child prostitution in the state, we need to lower the amount of pimps that are present in the state. In order to do so, we need to discourage them from participating in the industry. Unfortunately, the incentives for partaking in the industry are very great in the state of Oregon. Doug Justice, a sergeant on the Portland Police Squad who deals with underage prostitution, estimates that a pimp with one young girl can make $1,000 a day, 7 days a week, 30 days in a month. On top of that, the market for pimps is much more attractive than, let's say, drug markets, because it is much harder to pass harsher legislation on them or give them harsher penalties when it comes to being thrown in jail or things of that sort. And so it is my personal opinion that we must pass this harsher legislation in order to counteract these incentives. This bill will successfully discourage pimps from entering the child prostitution industry by making prostituting a minor a Class B felony, regardless of whether the pimp was aware the minor was a minor or not. And so by passing this bill, we can expect a series of positive things to follow. First off, we would see more runaways get home safely. Currently, it is estimated that for every child who runs away from home, one out of three will be taken into slavery within 48 hours of running away. If there are less pimps, then theoretically these kids should be safer on the streets. Second of all, we should expect the amount of adult prostitutes in the state of Oregon to drop over time. It is estimated that one-fourth of all prostitutes started out as minors, and Evan Nicholas, who is an agent in the Crimes Against Children Unit at the FBI headquarters in Washington, claims that 100% of the prostitutes he has personally interviewed said they started out as minors. While it may be unreasonable to expect a 25% drop in adult prostitution, some considerable drop should be expected. Third, the physical abuse charges committed by pimps should drop over time. Typically, pimps will use physical abuse methods in order to keep their victims under control. Such examples of torture used on the victims would include breaking bones, branding, or even starving the victim. Side effects of the sex slave industry in general include the transmission of STDs, sterility, miscarriages, menstrual problems, forced abortions, and severe anal or vaginal tearing among most victims. If less pimps are around, then less amount of these crimes should occur. In summary, to summarize briefly, Senate Bill 425 should be passed because it discourages pimps by making underage prostitution an automatic Class B felony, regardless of whether the pimp knew his slave's age or not. This will help the cause of abolishing child sex slavery in the state of Oregon, which in turn will protect future runaways, lower adult prostitution numbers, and reduce the amount of physical abuse crimes. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Grace. Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Grace Lounsbury, and I'm a student at West Salem High School, which is located at 1776 Titan Drive Northwest. I support Senate Bill 425 because the actions provided for in the bill would help to reduce the number of pimps involved in human trafficking, thus reducing the number of children taken into child prostitution, and will also lead to more proper convictions for pimps. Studies show that there are approximately 30 million people enslaved today, and half are estimated to be minors. Through the actions of Senate Bill 425, pimps who force these children into prostitution could face a greater burden for their actions because they would lose the defense of not knowing the age of the minor. The legal actions provided for in the bill would discourage anyone involved in or considering becoming involved in the atrocious business of human trafficking. Less and less children will be forced into human trafficking because less people will consider becoming a trafficker. Pimps often use brutal tactics to subdue their victims, such as beatings, electric shock, as well as psychological and mental abuse. Pimps will use any possible method to keep the child prostitutes under control. Evan Nicholas, FBI Supervisory Special Agent in the Crimes Against Children Unit, has found that the life expectancy of a child after becoming involved in prostitution is 7 to 9 years. The violence imposed on the victims is far greater than the shortened sentence a pimp might receive due to the lack of strict liability laws. Donico T. Johnson of Portland, Oregon, was sentenced to about 16 years in prison in June 2010 for sex trafficking a minor, a sentence far lighter than the 30-year penalty a Sacramento area man, who was also charged with the same crime, got. California has a strict liability law, while Oregon does not, and as the above penalties show, it makes a big difference. Senate Bill 425 should be passed because it will discourage people from becoming traffickers and properly prosecute pimps for their inhumane crimes. These two factors will create a safer society for children and ultimately lessen the amount of children involved in human trafficking. The bill is the first step towards eradicating human trafficking in the state of Oregon and eventually the world. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Do any members have any questions?
Thank you. Thank you for coming. It's great testimony. I know when I was your age, I wasn't doing such important things as you are. Would our friend Donico here got 30 years in Oregon if this bill had been in place in Oregon? You and I answer
that? Donico?
I don't know. Donico P. Johnson. I'm sure he's the guy that got 30 years in California. Oh, forgive me, 16 in Oregon, yeah. But would have got 30 in California.
Someone else got 30 in California.
Yes, would that penalty be imposed under this bill?
70 months. 70 months without the time.
76 months per count. Yeah. Well, Representative Hicks, are you done?
I'm done. Okay, yeah, it's 70 months per count under Measure 11 without good time, so no option for early release. Each count, of course, can apply to the same victim as to a separate unrelated incident or separate victims. So it's hard to really predict. I mean, I don't know the Donico case, but inevitably they'll be doing hard time.
Anything further?
Only, Mr. Chair, that the longer the better. My punishments are all illegal and unconstitutional, but thank you for indulging me.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, are you still here? Why don't you come on up? It's easier to call you that than the other.
That's fine. I understand. Once again, good morning, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is J.R. Ujifusa. I'm a deputy district attorney, and I'm actually assigned to human trafficking cases for Multnomah County. So I prosecute these individuals. In addition to that, I'm representing the ODAA, and I want to let you know that Department of Justice also supports this bill. First thing I would like to say is I'd like to thank the students who are here today, those who testified, and they are exactly right, that minors are sold over and over again. Unlike drugs or guns, which can be sold once, minors are sold multiple times a day, every day of the year. Pimps and traffickers that I deal with have one thing in mind, and that is money. And the easiest way to make the most amount of money quickly is through minors involved in prostitution. They seek out these individuals. I am in support of Senate Bill 425 because it adds two things and closes two loopholes that I see in trial on a daily basis. The first is, under the current law right now, the wording is induce or cause. That would be changed to aid and facilitate for a minor. The reason we need this is because it is a common defense for traffickers and pimps to have their, either they testify or their attorney states that they didn't induce or cause because this minor was prostituting before they met them. That it was, they didn't induce or cause this individual. This will stop that defense. This will show that any aiding in a minor who's involved in prostitution will be a ballot Measure 11 crime. It will send a clear message to traffickers that happen to be involved wherever they are in the chain of victimization, whether they are the first trafficker, the second, or the third, that they will be held accountable for aiding and facilitating a minor in prostitution. In addition, age is no defense, or mistake of age is no defense. At this point in time, I have to prove that a pimp knows or a trafficker knows the age of the victim. That can be very difficult. Pimps groom their victims not to tell police their age. They groom their victims to not to tell police that their trafficker or pimp knew their age. So that is a very difficult hurdle that prosecutors have to get through right now. This would allow us to prosecute any individual no matter whether we can prove that, prove they knew or not, but that the fact that the minor is a victim. This bill, with House Bill 2714, will make sure to protect victims no matter what excuse offenders give as to age. Senate Bill 425 protects minor victims and sends a clear message to traffickers that there is nowhere to hide if you prey on minors. I'm here to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Representative Schaffer.
Thank you. I should have saved my question for you.
Yes.
It's a mandatory minimum sentence, but if there's some real heinous person who is guilty of several counts of mistreating our youth, they can go to jail for a lot longer than 70 months, can't they?
Yes, yes. This Good. Is just per incident, and Thank this you. Isn't taking into account other sort of crimes as well as running these consecutive. So, yes, they can go to jail for a much longer period of time, and we see that very often.
Garrett?
Okay, what's our best estimate of how widespread this is in the Portland area? How many minors are being trafficked?
That is very difficult to answer. One of the reasons is that, like domestic violent crimes or other sexual assaults, it goes unreported very often. But I would say that talking to the vice officers in Portland, they see an average of between 1 to 5 cases a week. So it is a large problem in just the Portland area. And Representative Tomei and I believe County Commissioner McKeel were right in saying that this happens throughout the state. And in fact, one of the methods pimps use to groom minors is to take them from a small town to a place that they're not familiar with. So that would be a rural area in Oregon or another city in Oregon, and take them to Portland or another town, because if they're not familiar with that area, the only person they can rely on is their trafficker or pimp.
Okay, Representative Hicks. Okay.
Chairman of the Committee, Chair, could you give us examples of what's meant by aids or facilitates?
Sure. Now, remember, all of these is knowingly, so it's not a taxi cab driver who doesn't know what's going on. These are individuals who know what the act is going to happen, so a prostitution act, and that they aid in a way to help make it easier for that prostitution act to happen. It would be individuals standing guard by a hotel room while a minor is involved in a prostitution act. It would be individuals who post ads on the internet, putting a minor's picture on there, putting a prices, and then driving them to that act, knowing exactly what's going to happen. So in no way is this someone caught who does not know what's going on. This would require the same knowing attributes that we already have for compelling prostitution. This would just add the aid and facilitate for minors to catch those individuals who will use the defense, I didn't cause or induce, because this individual was already doing it when I met them.
Anybody, anything further?
Thank you very much.
We have Jim Moran and Sashon Sweet. Are they here? And then also Lynn Haxton.
Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, I'm Shoshone Thomas-Sweet. I'm with the Oregon Center for Christian Values, and our group has been working to mobilize citizens.
Can you state your name yet?
Shoshone Thomas-Sweet with the Oregon Center for Christian Values. We're a statewide nonprofit group that's been mobilizing Christians to speak up about the human trafficking issue. We worked previously in last sessions on a bill that granted victims confidentiality to women who faced abuse, and we also worked to pass the sticker bill, which allowed our volunteers to put human trafficking stickers in over 10,000 letters that were sent out through the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to all OLCC establishments in the state. We also helped to have the rally this January 11th, National Human Trafficking Awareness Day, where over 200 citizens came to the Capitol and stood on the steps to bring attention to the fact that this is a real, genuine problem across the state of Oregon. Portland gets a lot of focus in the human trafficking discussions because, obviously, it's our largest metropolitan area. But I want to point out that we had groups coming in from as far away as Coos Bay, Astoria, and Seaside on that day, because this problem is also happening in our small towns. Right now, obviously, the most resources available to deal with victims are available in Portland metro area. That's where we have the shelters. That's where we've got the Sexual Assault Resource Center. That's where we've got Christian groups like Rahab Sisters and Scarlet Cord doing ministry to prostitutes. The idea that this could be solved by a city or by a community alone is false. We have to have the members of this committee pass legislation to protect victims wherever they are in the state of Oregon, whether it be Klamath Falls, Baker City, or any other area. We can't assume that churches, counties, and cities are going to be able to tackle this issue on a piecemeal basis. So I want to thank the committee for considering Senate Bill 425 and giving it support. One of the most important things about the human trafficking problem is changing the perception that prostitution is a victimless crime. Prostitutes are suffer from incredible levels of psychological and physical damage. The levels of post-traumatic stress syndrome that they experience are beyond what a returning Army veteran would experience. You heard a student earlier giving testimony that the life expectancy for a young woman who is forced into prostitution is between 7 to 8 years. They die very quickly from physical abuse and the drug abuse. The common perception is that young prostitutes engage in prostitution in order to facilitate a drug habit. That is entirely erroneous. They participate in a drug habit to survive the violence and sexual abuse that occurs with being sold on a daily basis to strangers for sex. Right now, we've got a great slate of bills that have come through the Senate and the House to deal with human trafficking, but this is only going to be a first step. There's going to have to be subsequent laws in sessions down the road that help deal with a host of peripheral issues. I think that the idea that you could traffic somebody when they're 17 years old and as soon as they turn 18, it's just not as much of a crime, is something that should be seriously considered in the future. Overall, I just want to reiterate that the Oregon faith community is staunchly behind being a part of the solution in ending human trafficking and sexual slavery in Oregon, but we can't do it without a strong partnership from the state. Part of that will be the passage of Senate Bill 425, and I'd also like you to consider in the future how we're going to come up with about $1.2 million of funds on an annual basis to provide a secure lockdown shelter for minors who are victims of human trafficking. Right now, when I speak at churches and at Christian colleges, I have people holding up canning jars asking for spare change in order to fund a shelter. And while that is a noble and appropriate response, I think we need to seriously consider whether the adult entertainment industry, which profits millions of dollars every year from the exploitation of young women, should not at some level pay for the externalized damage that they cause to our most vulnerable citizens. I know this is a little bit off topic, but thanks very much for considering Senate Bill 425, and I do hope that you will pass it today. Thank you.
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, and members of the committee, my name is Lynn Haxton. I'm a staff attorney with Youth Rights and Justice, formerly the Juvenile Rights Project. Youth Rights and Justice supports policy efforts to reduce the commercial sexual exploitation of children. We do, however, have concerns about Senate Bill 425 and recommend changes to the bill. Current language under Section C expands the compelling statute to aids or facilitates the commission of prostitution by a person under 18 years of age. Unfortunately, pimps often use girls to teach, experienced girls to teach the new girls the trade. They do this for multiple reasons, to remove themselves from the enterprise of prostitution, to protect them from law enforcement. They use it to show they have power and control over the current girls, and I use the term girls, not meaning it's only girls. There are boys involved in this. But they also use it to show they have power control to the new girls because they can see what they can make their current girls do. This is a very serious crime. I'm very concerned that other children who are caught in the web of the trafficker will be charged with conduct under this bill. And we urge that language be added to apply to adult offenders only, and in order to protect our children who are victims of commercial sexual exploitation. I'm happy to answer any questions of the committee.
Any members? President Garrett?
Wouldn't a 16-year-old, the person you're worried about, wouldn't that be a defense to the charge against that girl, that she was being coerced by the pimp to assist him in recruiting other girls? I would think that would be a legal defense.
The defenses allowed, if for instance duress, have very high requirements. And these girls are manipulated to the point where they believe that they're doing this of their own free will because they love the trafficker. And it's very hard for them to disengage. They're just completely caught up in the web of what the trafficker has convinced them. So I'm concerned that that would be a hard defense.
Mr. Taylor?
Chair, members of the committee, this issue came up in the work group. It came up in the Senate. And we actually had an amendment at one point that would basically say that if you're under the age of 18, compelling prostitution didn't apply to you. What the district attorneys and law enforcement community brought up is the fact that there are some kids under 18 that are acting just like a pimp. What we did is when we expanded the aids of facilitate to the commission of the crime that you've already heard is, we exempted out juveniles from that particular provision, and that's over on page 3 of the bill. And what it does is, and it's very accurate in some ways, technically accurate, but it doesn't explain it. What it says is, as it relates to 137.707, AIDS, and this is the measure 11 part that applies just to juveniles, it references back section 1A, B, and D, that you'll see in the first page. A is use of force, B induces or causes, and then it eliminates C. It doesn't reference C, which is aids or facilitates the commission of prostitution by a person under the age of 18. So the end result is if you're aiding or facilitating and you're under 18, you are not subject to the mandatory 70-month sentence under Measure 11. You would be tried in juvenile court. The juvenile court could, if they wanted to, refer you to adult court. But in juvenile court, the court has a tremendous amount of discretion as to what to do. Now, as to the fact Penn mentioned before, my assumption is that the aiding and assisting, if it's inducing or causing, that's a problem now. And the solution to that would be a policy issue of taking all juveniles out of the compelling prostitution statute. But as it relates to aiding or facilitating, I believe what was adopted in the Senate amendment addresses the issue as it relates to juveniles.
Committee members, is that to me?
Thank you. Thank you for both of you for your testimony. Ms. Hexton, you talked about, and I'm aware of this too, about how the girls become enamored of their pimps and they think they're in love with them and they're helping them, et cetera, et cetera. So tell me your position and the position of Youth Rights and Justice now on how do we keep those kids safe so that they don't, after they're picked up, so that they don't run back to their pimps.
Chair Barker and Krieger, members of the committee, I think that's a tough question, and we are all struggling with trying to get an appropriate shelter and services to meet the needs of these children who've been victimized. I don't know exactly what that will look like. There is talk of everything from a secure locked facility to one that's not, because until they're ready to change, locking them up isn't going to facilitate that. So at this point, I'm not certain what it looks like. I think, you know, we will be probably braving new territory when we get to that, as there are only a few shelters across the country and they are all using different, you know, methods. So I think we're braving new territory.
Mr. Chair, if I may, then this is an issue that, as Bill is well aware, that we discussed at length in the meetings that we had during the interim about this issue, because what we're hearing from law enforcement is that when you place these kids in a foster home, they come in the front door and they go out the back door so they can call their pimps to come and pick them up. And very often then what they do too is take other kids in their foster home with them to tell them what a great life they've got out prostituting the streets. So it's a very big issue, and I'm not sure we have any answers yet on how we keep these kids secure until we can help them see themselves as victims so that they can move on with their lives in a more healthy way. But right now, I think it's really difficult if there aren't facilities that are secure. It's hard to keep these kids in because, as you said, they don't see themselves as victims.
Any further questions, comments? Okay, thank you both. Was there anyone else that had signed up for this bill? Okay, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 425 and open a hearing on Senate Bill 356.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as amended, this is a bill that the Department of Corrections asked us for. Eliminates the Department of Corrections pilot program involving the treatment of sex offenders with a hormone antiandrogen such as, I can't pronounce it, it's
Depo-Provera,
a common name. Mr. Chairman of the committee. Mr. Chairman of the committee, I was a staff person when they adopted this pilot program.
It looks like they're here without me calling them, so that's good.
Sorry about that.
Go ahead and start anywhere you want.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Cindy Booth. I'm the administrator for Transition and Release, Department of Corrections. And I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 356A, which eliminates the statutory requirement for the Department of Corrections to operate a treatment program for sex offenders who would be required to partake in Depo-Provera injections once they have been released from prison. The Department of Corrections has attempted to operate this pilot program since 1999 with limited success. And in the past about 14 months, we have been unable to locate persons or professionals who would be willing to conduct the evaluations required by statute to determine whether a person would or would not be required to use Depo-Provera upon post-release from prison. I have submitted written testimony and would be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair, I'm just curious, how many other states are doing this?
Co-chairs and Representative Olson, to my knowledge, no other state requires Depo-Provera injections either during or post-release as part of sex offender treatment.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Co-chair Barker, co-chair Krieger. I'm Allison Kinsey. I am the manager of the Adult Sex Offender Supervision Program for the Department, Multnomah County Department of Community Justice, and I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 356A. Multnomah County also currently does not have a licensed medical professional that can perform the Depo-Provera evaluations and the follow-up medical monitoring that's required. How we're handling that is that offenders who are in need of medical management are referred to their primary care providers. Over the past 3 years, approximately 28 offenders received Depo-Provera evaluations through this pilot program that we're speaking of. That's about 9 per year. An average of 8 or fewer offenders were on Depo-Provera at any one time. And at the time that the program was concluded due to lack of medical oversight, which was in June of 2010, 5 offenders were receiving Depo-Provera injections. So thank you very much, and I'd be pleased to answer any questions.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Jeremiah Stromberg. I'm the executive director with the Oregon Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. I'm here on behalf of the board as the board supports this bill. And as you've heard from my colleagues, the board is well aware of the barriers that are in place for this pilot program, and therefore we support the termination of this specific pilot program. Ultimately, even without this pilot program, it does not prevent the board from exercising its authority to implement the most appropriate treatment that may come forward from a sex offender treatment provider, from community corrections, and ultimately that's available in the community. And so it doesn't limit our ability to still hold sex offenders accountable to any particular treatment or sanction option that may be available. And I'm here to answer any questions you may have as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just somewhat confused. I'm not sure which of you can answer this, but it sounds like what you're saying is nobody's saying that it didn't work. You're just saying you don't want to continue it because it's hard to find providers to provide the Depo-Provera. Am I correct?
You want to answer?
The Depo-Provera is prescribed off-label. And there are few to no medical providers today who are willing to prescribe it as such. Depo-Provera for offenders who were highly sexualized did work for some. However, there are other options that we also have available to us. SSRIs are one. Also, plethysmograph biofeedback is another. We were not able to run the pilot study as set forth in the legislation in order to determine the actual effect of the program.
Want to add to that?
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say that there are two parts to the requirement. The Department of Corrections was required to conduct or cause to be conducted evaluations to determine if a person would be appropriate for that requirement post-release. And then in the community corrections agencies would have to contract with persons or organizations that would be willing to provide the injections, to actually inject the person with the Depo-Provera drug. And so there are in those two ways, it became increasingly difficult because of the off-label use. People were not willing to say that a person would or would not benefit from the treatment post-release, and then those in the community were saying they were unwilling to cause a person to be injected with the drug because it was not for its intended use.
So why didn't you use the labeled drug? Why did you use the off-label?
Depo-Provera is a drug that was created not for use in the treatment of sex offenders.
Ah, okay.
So in that way, it's an off-label use.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
This was a pilot project, and I don't have the original legislation. Was there any type of report that was supposed to ever come back to the effectiveness of what you were doing?
Yes, the statute did require a report, and a report was requested. It was not conclusive.
Do you know when that case was brought to was it brought back to the legislature?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, I would need to do some research to know the answer to that question and when the report was given.
Mr. Taylor?
Chair, members of the committee, I have vague recollections of the report, and what did stick out in my mind was that Depo-Provera is not effective, and Cindy can, the treatment people can tell me otherwise, on certain sex offenders, particularly sex offenders who are driven by control more than a hormonal issue. And I think I'm reading between the lines here that the difficulty in probably getting providers goes to the liability issue.
Co-chairs, members of the committee council is correct that the persons who we previously contracted with to conduct the evaluations as well as the community providers do see a huge liability question that has heretofore been unanswered.
Any further comments or questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 356. And opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 383. Fritz, is it Batson?
That's correct. Co-chairs, members of the committee, Senate Bill 383 pertains to the forms by which the initial or secondary notice of a residential defect may be sent. This will make a few small changes to that section, allowing notice to be sent by certified mail, exempting small claims and counterclaims from this requirement, and
Good afternoon, Chairs Krieger and Barker, members of the committee. My name is Fritz Batson. I'm an attorney from Eugene, and I'm here today representing the construction law section of the Oregon State Bar. The bill that has been proposed came to some degree out of the construction law section because of issues that have come up in the Notice of Residential Defect statutes. Just very quickly, those statutes require a plaintiff to give a notice to their contractor, and it has very specific requirements, and it has ways that it's supposed to be delivered, including registered mail, and then a follow-up series of notices that occur after that, as well as inspections, and then ultimately a 90-day response time for the general contractor before anything can be done. What this bill does is it only changes a couple of small parts of that Notice of Residential Defect statute. First thing it does is it doesn't just rely on registered mail as being the way of delivering the notice. It allows for certified mail, which is much more commonly used. The second thing it does is it exempts small claims actions from having to go through this long series of notices and sub-notices and waiting for a response from the general contractor, and instead allows for a more efficient resolution of small claims matters without having to go through that process. The third thing it does is if, in fact, a contractor has sued one of the plaintiff already and there's a pending lawsuit and the plaintiff wants to counterclaim in some fashion for a problem with the defective work, they don't have to give a notice, wait for the time frame to roll by before you can bring a counterclaim. We found that's fairly very inefficient and operates basically as a stay of the case for 90 days. And so the idea is, look, if you've already been sued, you can bring a counterclaim and you don't have to go through the notice of residential defect statute. And so we would ask that the committee support this, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair, actually I have a question of committee counsel. Being a licensed contractor in Oregon, would you advise I declare a potential conflict on this if this goes to work session? Or just to cover myself, I probably will, but I just was curious if that's necessary. I've never had a complaint at CCB, I'm proud to say, but because I haven't done any work in 6 years except for on my own property.
Can't get a complaint for not working.
And co-chairs, Representative Schaffler, that's this is not an expert area for me, but that's a pretty big classification
that's
of people, subcontractors.
Right.
I don't think that's narrow enough to create a conflict.
Thank you.
Anything further, committee? Thank you. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 383 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 878. We have four people signed up, and I think I'll have the Portland Lieutenant Marshman, and the Chief come up, please. Is she here? Is the Chief here?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Senate Bill 878A makes modification to the large list of exceptions that are already in existence to the general requirement that any private security personnel be licensed and trained. There are two exceptions that would be added. The first would make a modification to the existing subsection K, which has to do with individuals who are working for a licensee of OLCC, working the door gate area for age verification. This would add or controlling access at the entrance of the premises, and it would specify that these individuals cannot be armed and cannot take quote-unquote enforcement action. Secondly, it would modify section G pertaining to individuals who monitor fire alarm systems and other alarm systems that are not designed to detect unauthorized intrusions. It modifies this to the language to everything except those designed to detect threats to public safety or personal well-being.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, and members of the committee. My name is Mike Marshman. I'm a lieutenant for the Portland Police Bureau. My current assignment is the day shift lieutenant at Central Precinct, where most of our downtown nightlife establishments are located. But previously, I was the homicide and assault lieutenant for the city of Portland, so I have some knowledge of when some of these establishments, issues at these establishments go south. I investigated some of those crimes. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in opposition to Senate Bill 878, which would eliminate the requirement for certification of front doormen at liquor-licensed establishments. The City of Portland opposes this proposed legislation because certification for security personnel is essential at alcohol establishments, and in fact, front doormen do act as the frontline security for these businesses. Maintaining security generally is voluntary to the licensee. If an establishment is one that needs this type of security, they should be certified, just as servers of alcohol are licensed to serve. DPSST certification provides the training, education, and screening of these applicants that would provide this service. Industry representatives have been strong advocates for the training and education as a best practice in these establishments, alcohol establishments. And DPSST certification is a major portion of the education, which involves training for de-escalation, which is crucial, the recognition of intoxicated persons, and other examples of that type. DPSST certification provides education and training on the laws surrounding use of force in the front of these establishments and limits to a security person's authority in these use of force encounters. Certification of individuals in a position to use communication techniques with intoxicated individuals is essential to controlling public harm and preventing public harm. The certification provides a background check, which in my opinion and the city's opinion is also very crucial, ensuring that the people who have a history of violence and or are felons are not eligible for providing security services. De-escalation of issues is one of the most important components in a doorman's job at a licensed location. People who are drinking are more impulsive, they're quick to behave in an aggressive manner, and they can be quite irrational. DPSST certification provides training to assist the establishment's employees in this skill. This Senate bill is unlikely to change the behavior of experienced and responsible bar owners, as they already continue to use certified security because of the known benefits. The change, though, will affect irresponsible bar owners, or those who are on the margin, the business margin, who may cut corners to maintain a profit in an environment over a safe environment. We've had numerous examples of locations that had public safety incidents as a direct result of uncertified and untrained security. The level of authority and accountability incumbent in these positions makes certification essential. Many establishments employ so few people that many have to be cross-trained in admissions and security and bar staff. They'd actually float around doing different functions. The cost of certification is not high, nor is the 8-hour class an unreasonable time commitment to learn these skills. The benefits are incredibly effective at mitigating harm, and the City of Portland respectfully requests that you do not advance this legislation. Thank you.
Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak in opposition to Senate Bill 878, which would eliminate the requirement for certification of front doormen at liquor license establishment. I'm Teresa Marchetti. I'm the City of Portland's liquor licensing specialist. I work closely with the Portland Police Bureau and also the neighborhoods to address problems at licensed establishments. I also sit on many policy work groups at the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, and the industry, as well as the commission, have always been strong advocates for education and training in order to be proactive in addressing issues at licensed establishments. The training that's provided by DPSST is really a component of those best practices that we talk about all the time in that venue. Being proactive is the most effective way of effectively mitigating problems that are associated with the irresponsible service of alcohol. Professional security who understand the liabilities that are associated with alcohol service, and also the responsibilities of the licensee that they're actually representing, are extremely important. There's really no difference between a front doorman and a security person at a licensed establishment. There just isn't. Practically, that individual is there to assess people for intoxication levels. If they're going to come into that establishment, they're there to enforce the standards that have been relayed to them by the ownership. And they're also there to check if they're, to make sure that the proper age of those individuals, that those people are at the proper age to enter. They're in a clear position to deny entrance and to deal with potentially irrational behavior, depending on the level of alcohol consumption that has already taken place. The past records and the background checks that are also provided by DPSST are also very, very valuable to licensees and licensed establishments, because DPSST keeps a record of locations where security officers have worked in the past that allows licensees to know the past behaviors of their officers. Both security and patrons in the City of Portland have been hurt because of poor decision-making that was made by people in a capacity for security that would have been addressed in the training if they had been certified, which they were not. We had an incident where an uncertified doorman thought he was within his rights to pepper spray individuals that were outside on the sidewalk, which he was most clearly not. This happened on several different occasions. Over half of the problem locations that we deal with in the City of Portland to some degree have something to do with the security personnel and the fact that they're not certified. Really, we have a lot of concerns with this bill as it is right now. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak. I'd be happy to answer questions.
The members?
Yeah, thank you. I just some clarification. So So if I own a bar, anybody I have working security needs to be trained, needs to be certified, or can I just hire anybody?
As it is now, they do need to be certified.
So the issue is somebody checking at the front door, and a representative from the restaurant industry recently said, oh, this is really different because they're just looking at age, checking age, but you just cited the other things involved, the level of intoxication and so on.
Absolutely.
That's the difference. And let me understand this bill. As I understand it, says that you have to be certified, but not the guy at the door, and that's what you're asking us to undo that portion. I'm thinking back to the time before there was a long time before there was certification, when a friend of mine's dad owned a bar, and the friend was a kind of rough and tumble guy to say the least, and so he told his dad, I'd like to be the bouncer. And his dad said, I'm not having you as the bouncer because you'd be like the old West bringing every gunslinger in town to try you out. And so the dad was the OLCC thinking along those lines. So I can see where that could really be a problem with having the wrong guy at the front door.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for bringing that to us. Representative Nolan.
Thank you. I was trying to pay close attention, Lieutenant Marshman, to your testimony, but I want to make sure I heard it correctly. We're talking about a certification program through DPSST that requires each attendee to participate for one day, 8 hours worth of training at DPSST. Did I get that correctly?
Yes, that is correct. One 8-hour day.
If I might follow up, it's not the long or even a short refresher course of DPSST that some of us might be thinking about. It's specifically geared just to this activity for security at OLCC licensed facilities.
Yes, it's just a 1 day, 8-hour day on security.
Makes good sense to me.
I think, Mr. Co-Chair, on the same vein, what's the cost for the 8-hour training? If you know.
I'll go ahead and answer that, Co-Chairs, members of the committee. The cost is $80 for a 2-year certification, and then there's also a $50 fee for fingerprinting because of the background investigation, which is standard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm assuming, looking at the bill, you have no problems with line 17, which is people monitoring alarm systems, but you have problems with line 25, controlling access at the entrance of the premises. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Anything further?
Mr. Co-Chair? Perhaps council can edify why we're combining these two activities in one bill, other than that they're both relating to DPSST, the fire alarm and the bouncers.
Co-chairs, Representative Nolan, I can certainly tell you what happened on the other side, which is came in introduced with just the OLCC exception. The introduction of the alarms came in late, sponsored by Senator Bonamici. There wasn't a tremendous amount of discussion, I think. Clearly it fits the relating clause, but that issue was just, you know, a minor modification in terms of scope, so they sort of snuck it on. I think it was characterized on that side as the less significant of the two.
How does that relating clause get to fire alarms? Is that what you're talking about?
Mm-hmm. Yes, co-chairs and Chair Krieger, the important part of that, all of this is sort of propped up as being a variance from a certification requirement. It's all part and parcel of the same statute. So I think any exception pertaining to any of these sub-listings, which are variances from a normal licensing and certification requirement that would implicate DPSST, would be fair game.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate you coming down here, and thanks for your service. But I got to tell you, when I was in college, I was a bartender. I served tables, and I was a doorman. I did all those things all at the same time in one bar. I did all those things different times at different places. One thing I struggle here with, and I've talked to some bar owners about this, I'm behind the bar. I'm the only one working there. I'm all those things, but I don't have a security training. I know it's only 8 hours, but I don't have those things. But I literally am all those things. I can literally say, you're not of age, you're intoxicated, you're not behaving, you have to go. You're acting as the doorman, essentially. You are security because you're the only one in the bar, yet you don't have the security training. You take the very same person, put them on a bar stool at the front door, screening people, doing what they've just doing behind the bar, and by magic, they're required to have 8 hours of training. I'm struggling with that. I understand the need to provide that some, and some of these larger establishments that are very busy, that require security at all the entrances, I definitely see that. But for just the mom-and-pop place, I'm just struggling for it. I understand where you're trying to get at, but to overlay this training for every place, I know it isn't great cost, but it's another hoop to jump through. That's what I'm struggling with. So, but I appreciate your efforts.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Representative Shuffler, like Red Robin as an example, serves alcohol, but they don't have, you know, to kind of tee off your example, they don't have this issue. These you know, establishments that do provide and need security are the ones that this is focused on. You know, the establishments, as in your example, you know, one person, kind of jack of all trades, where this is geared to, that just wouldn't work. We're talking establishments where you have lines of people down the street, kind of like the front line eyes and ears for essentially what this comes down to is public safety. In the law enforcement profession, we rely on that front door person probably more than the folks inside, because all the crimes and homicides that I've investigated, you could see it spilling from outside in. That's what this is geared towards, not the mom and pop type of establishments.
When I was running the bar, if it spilled out on the sidewalk, that's where it spilled out to, and if they want to go out and beat their heads up together on the sidewalk, that is their problem. I would recommend, if I had a staff, I'd say don't go out on the sidewalk. Once it leaves the door, I wouldn't worry about it. I don't know exactly what my liability would be, but I mean, once you get the problem out the door, I just go back in and go to work.
Well, co-chairs,
can I add something? Co-chairs and Representative Shuffler, I think that that's why the majority of or liquor license establishments, it's not a requirement that they actually have security. That really is on a decision made by the owner or the licensee as to whether or not they think that that extra staff person is needed. In a situation where it's a small bar where there is one bartender staff member that can do the sort of the jack of all trades, and you'll see them go back into the kitchen, come out into the bar, go all around. The thought is that is not a security needed issue. If we're seeing a mom and pop shop that is having a lot of problems, that has fights spilling out into onto the sidewalk, then we're going to be discussing with them their need for security, their need for that extra person, obviously, because that bartender is just stretched at that point too far to handle the capacity.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. Let me make it very clear. Let's say they have, I'm not talking about a place that has a bunch of fights. I'm talking about a place that has, you know, minimum staff. They don't have a lot of problems. They may have an event one night, and they just want to check at the door because maybe somebody that normally doesn't come there may be trying to get in that doesn't belong in there. I'm not talking about a chronic problem establishment here at all. Mm-hmm. What I don't understand is a person that's been working behind the bar for years maybe, who's been doing all of these things, but then by magic, when they step out from behind the bar and they put this person right there on a bar stool, just checking IDs, which I've done. You know, I just fail to see. I'm not talking about fighting with people. I'm not talking about arm wrestling or spraying people with mace or breaking up fights or going out in the street and saving lives. Just checking someone's ID before they come in. I just, and what we're doing here is we're painting with a broad brush for something that may be required in certain instances, just like you said, the examples you use, where a certain amount of level of security is necessary. But that's not what most places need if they're just having a special night. They want to check IDs before they come in. But yet we're requiring this extra amount of training and one more thing to do. When, to be quite frank with you, I don't think it's necessary. If you have professional security on the grounds, then I understand. That's a horse of a different color. But to make every single person that may or may not possibly check IDs at the door, strictly just to check the age of people coming in, I think that's just going a little bit too far. In my humble opinion, that's my opinion.
Thank you for indulging.
Thank you, Chair Krieger. I wanted to make a brief point. Representative Schaffler, checking ID for the purpose of age verification already exists as an exception. This expands that to and controlling access at the entrance of a premises. So right now, you're just sitting on a bar stool checking ID. You're already subject to an exception from the licensing and training.
Mr. Chair, it's a redundancy then, because if you're not 21, you don't get in. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
Mr. Co-Chair.
You can't where I hang out and drink beer.
Let's not be naive.
Representative Nolan.
Now I'm being accused of being naive, Mr. Chair.
Redundancy, we had that a while back in a bill.
Council made the point I was going to make.
Okay, Representative Wong.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I just wanted to add for the record here, because I know we're having a good discussion, but I mean, I would think that we would want establishments to have fewer barriers to having someone there assisting with checking ID, and that even a $130 cost, particularly in the instances like Representative Schaffler was talking about, where there might be one event in the summertime or two or three events in the summertime, if we add even what appears on the face to be a minor barrier, they may just decide not to have an extra layer of people checking IDs out front, because that's another $130 per person in an eight-hour day. You throw on some wages for their training, and before you know it, to have four or five people checking IDs at the door, you're looking at a $1,200 or $1,300 cost. Wouldn't we be better off as a public policy encouraging them not to incur that cost and have five people at the door? I just wanted that for the record. And I have to leave for an appointment, and I apologize, everyone. It's not any indication on this discussion, but I thought we'd be done around. So, excuse me.
Thank you. I'm asking this of staff. So what was the genesis of this bill? It came from this committee or from the Senate committee, I'm assuming. So I want to know what the genesis of the bill is. And also, if the bill doesn't pass, if the alarm system passes, then does the situation stay the same so that these folks who do control access at the entrance, then they are required to go through DPST?
Co-Chairs, Representative Tomei, if the bill doesn't pass, the existing system of sitting and checking an ID would continue under an exception. Individuals who control access at the entrance of a premises would be subject to licensing requirements. This adds an exception for controlling access at the entrance of a premises. Remember, it gets a little tricky, I think, because the opponents of the bill went first, so we haven't heard from the proponents.
Okay.
So the passage of the bill would expand that exception for individuals who control access. They would no longer be required to undergo that training. Right now, they are.
They are. And so what is the problem? So why change what the current situation is? I guess the proponents would answer that.
And
okay.
Co-Chairs, Representative Tomei, I will probably leave it to the proponents
okay.
of the bill
right.
to answer
Thank
that
you.
Question.
Any further questions, committee, of these people?
Well, I guess I have one more. So how many people are we talking about who, we heard that Red Robin would not be one, my local tavern in my neighborhood would not be one. But so we're talking about big places that have a lot of people stay on the weekends. How many are we talking about?
Well, Co-Chairs, Representative Tomei, in my opinion, the establishments we're talking about are essentially drinking establishments. They're not a place where you would take your children to get a cheeseburger at Red Robin. The sole purpose is, in my opinion, to go there and drink.
Follow up. So how many are we talking about in Portland? How many people have these kinds of people who check
Well, co-chairs, Representative Tomei, we have 2,700 licenses in the city of Portland. About 90% of those are retail, but it's very difficult off the top of my head to say how many are really primarily bar and tavern, because we would also be talking about, as Representative Shuffler referenced, there are times when your smaller bars and taverns will have a major event where they double or triple their normal capacity, and so in that case they would have security. But I would say probably at least 500 in the city of Portland that have on a regular basis DPSST certified security.
That's what I needed to know. Thank you very much.
Okay, committee members, anything further? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Teresa Nagel and Carol Schellen.
Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee.
Hi.
For the record, my name is Kara Thallon with the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify today in favor of Senate Bill 878. First off, Representative Tomei, I can hopefully shed some light on the genesis of this bill. I'll give you some background first, actually. There used to be a standard for training that stated if you carried a weapon or you detained people or you wore a uniform that said security across it, then you had to have this training. It was very clear. It was if you had any of those three, then you needed to have the training. I think about 6 or 8 years ago, it's before my time, so I don't know the exact date. There was a bar in Portland that actually was telling their bouncers to go in and throw people out on the street to sort of set an example. And the standard was changed in order to address some of those issues and to include enforcement action. We've always said that if you are authorizing physical force, that's a different issue, and we have no problem with requiring training for that piece, if you are authorizing any sort of physical force. However, checking ID for age verification was never mentioned in that. A couple of years after that, DPSST went further into the rule change and to say that although checking for age verification was not enforcement action, once you tell them you can't come inside, either because they are a minor or because they are visibly intoxicated, then you are considered controlling access, even if it's just to your neighborhood bar. And obviously, from our perspective, the act of moving someone out in front of your establishment to check IDs and deal with the issues of minors or visibly intoxicated before they enter your establishment should be encouraged. There's not really any instance where it's not better to know up front who is coming into your establishment. Removing someone who's drunk once they're already inside is usually when these issues tend to escalate. So hopefully that kind of explains the history of where we're coming from, the controlling access piece. This is coming up years later because in the last 2 years, local governments and OLCC have both started writing tickets specifically on this controlling access piece of the rule, saying that if you have someone sitting outside, check ID, once they say, no, you can't come inside the establishment, then they're controlling access. And my understanding of the tickets and some of the specific examples I got from some of the bar owners was that it wasn't even when they were viewing this happening, but they would ask a waiter or waitress or bartender, do you ever go out front and check IDs? Yes. So you control access. Do you have any sort of DPSST certification, and then write a ticket for not having the proper certification. So this was brought to our attention because some of our establishments are actually pulling their staff away from the door in order to avoid these fines, and now obviously these confrontations are having to happen inside of the establishment, which again makes it more problematic at that point. The bill says that if you're taking enforcement action, you still have to be certified. This specifically just exempts those who are checking ID at the door and controlling access to their own establishment. Hopefully that is a clear explanation. I'll take any questions if you have any.
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Teresa Noggle, and I'm the program manager for the Private Security Private Investigator Unit at the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, otherwise known as DPSST. Senate Bill 878A will make two changes to the list of exemptions in current statute, and as legislative staff mentioned earlier, it can be somewhat confusing when you're removing people from exemptions and adding them to exemptions and which one goes to which. So I'm going to take an opportunity to kind of go over this to see if it helps clear up as well. So Senate Bill 878A, as introduced in the Senate, adds to the list of people who are exempt from the requirements of private security certification, training, and background checks. Senate Bill 878A, as amended in the Senate, retained this newly proposed exemption, but it also removed an unrelated group of people from this law. With regards to the first element of the bill related to individuals who control access, this portion of the bill would remove the certification, training, and background check requirements for individuals who check the identification of patrons and control that patron's ability to enter the premises. However, because the language was placed under the crowd management section of this statute, the exemption will only apply if three specific conditions have been met. And these three conditions are in bullet format in the middle of the first page of my written testimony. And what those say are when there is a crowd attending or taking part in an organized event, such as a festival, a fair, a parade, for example, Kell's Irish Pub, they have an annual event where they have a very large organized event where a lot of people will come to their facility. There is one certified private security provider for every 10 non-certified individuals, and any enforcement action that must be taken by an individual who is either currently licensed or certified, or they have to be under the supervision of somebody who is currently licensed or certified. And although we cannot predict the exact amount of people who are going to be affected by this exemption, we utilize historic and current data to prepare an estimate of the fiscal anticipated revenue reduction in a fiscal impact statement. The second element that I would like to touch on is related to the fire alarm monitor section that we've heard about. As amended in the Senate, Senate Bill 878 removes fire alarm monitors from the list of exemptions and, in essence, requires them now to go through the background training and certification process requirements. DPSST currently certifies individuals who monitor intrusion alarms. So initial informal inquiry was done on how many of these fire alarm companies may be affected. We found that most of the companies that monitor fire alarms also monitor intrusion alarms, so they would already be under the requirements for certification. There are, however, a handful of companies out there who do exclusively monitor fire alarms only. In this case, these individuals would now be subject to the certification, training, and background checks. And I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have or clarify any of the earlier ones.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Ms. Nagle, so this training, you know, it takes 8 hours, costs between $80 and $130. It's mandatory. What are they learning? What is this training?
And Co-Chairs and Representative Hicks, if I may answer that question in kind of a larger context. The certification for 2 years as a private security provider is $80, and as mentioned earlier, it's $50 for the background check, and that is a pass-through fee to the Oregon State Police. The training that's involved is done by the industry representatives themselves. The only thing that DPSST regulates is the actual curriculum that's presented out there. So that training can occur either internally to an organization or it can be provided by the industry representatives themselves to their own people. The training that is provided to them includes everything from ethics to use of force to the laws. It deals with private citizens' arrest and several other topics of situations that they may become involved in.
Anything further?
Representative Tomei.
Thank you. I'm assuming it should be to Teresa. So, Teresa, so currently, what I seem to understand you saying is that DPSST or someone is fining people if they don't have this certification. They're people are being fined, that's why you're wanting to change the law. Am I understanding you correctly?
Yeah, I'm assuming that's me. Yes.
Did I not say the right name?
No, it's Kara. That's okay, though.
Kara, I'm sorry.
Yes, that is the case, that they're being fined if they're doing age verification at the door and they're not actually certified as with the DPSST training.
Follow-up? How often has that happened?
I don't have the exact number, but I can definitely get you that. I do know that when in one of our OLCC advisory committee meetings, it was discussed that it was their, over the last year, it had been their third most popular ticket, for lack of a better word, after selling to minors and visibly intoxicated.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Hicks. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, who's finding who and who keeps the revenue?
I do know that local government and I'm sorry, chairs, Representative Hicks. I do know that OLCC and local governments had been doing the tickets. I'm assuming DPSST also can do their own tickets. And as far as the revenue goes, that might be a question more suitable for you.
Co-chairs, Representative Hicks, typically DPSST will do an education piece with the individual. So we do not issue citations for this event if we contact somebody who may be in violation of the law. As I said, it's mostly education, and we help to get them into compliance.
Is Portland making money off of these violations?
I don't know if I have the answer to that.
I don't know one way or the other. I'm just asking.
Yeah.
Okay.
I can definitely, I mean, I personally, I don't know if I have that information, but I can definitely find out.
We can get that.
Okay, we'll get that.
Okay. Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. It seems to me that this language might be a bit more broad than you described, Karen. Your objective was. Seems to me the language in this bill casts a pretty broad expansion on this exception. And I wanted to understand if that's as broad as you intended, or did you intend, for example, to leave bouncers who regularly do some kind of security enforcement in, you know, people seem to... Let me ask, first of all, whether you intended to exclude them or whether you were intending to exclude only the folks that Representative Schaffler referenced, which is the bartender, owner, cook, bottle washer who occasionally goes outside to have a conversation, or did you also intend to include the bouncer whose primary, if not only, job is to enforce security for the premise?
Co-chairs, Representative Nolan, thanks for the question. Our intention was not to include bouncers into this language. If you look at line 25, it says, in controlling, for the purpose of age verification and controlling access at the entrance of the premises, but on line 27, someone who is not armed and is not hired with the primary responsibility of taking any sort of enforcement action would not be included in this. Our position is that if you are taking enforcement action or you are hired to specifically detain someone or be a security person at that bar, then you should have this training.
The follow-up then would be to counsel to ask whether the language in this bill accomplishes the objective that she just described, because it seems to me it's much broader than that.
And co-chairs, Representative Nolan, the important language is at ORS 1818708F. You see that referenced
which
in the bill.
Which we don't have here.
And I am about to share it with you. This is a subsection. That section generally describes private security forces and gives a list of activities that constitute private security enforcement. Subsection F refers to, quote, taking enforcement action by detaining persons or placing persons under arrest, and then provides the statute for arrest by private persons.
Committee, we have one more
and the
person.
Answer to my question is?
It's coming, yes. Chair Krieger, I'll be as quick as I can. That's all that is contained there. So if you detain someone, if you put them in a citizen's arrest because they've engaged in unlawful activity, I think that would fulfill that purpose. If you, say, expel somebody from property or shove somebody around a bit, not that bouncers do that, I don't believe that would be captured by that subsection. So I think it's only people you hire. Think of security that you're hiring for something like shoplifting, something like that, where you're hiring them as private security, but part of what they're going to do is actually detain or arrest somebody if there's a law violation. That's not what this is. I think that's the distinction that the statute is trying to make between that kind of private security that does actually detain and in that way assist law enforcement, and then just the sort of, well, not that, you know, maintaining order on the property.
Okay, thank you. Is Jim Moran here?
Co-chairs and members of the committee, my name is Jim Moran, and I own Oregon Beverage Services. My company specializes in the management and service of alcohol at special events throughout the state of Oregon. I guess I'm on the front lines as to whether my staff are bartenders, ID checkers, alcohol monitors, private security, or crowd management, or maybe they're all of the above. Rather than repeat information you've already heard, let me clarify some information as I see it from the field. 8 hours of training is required for a private security certification. In addition, 4 hours of practicum work. So the actual time spent is 12 hours. Someone gets to pay for that, whether it be the individual or my company. Background checks, fingerprintings is a fee. I believe that's a $50 fee. The license is $80, and that's good for 2 years and then has to be renewed. So the investment per employee for cash out of pocket is a couple hundred dollars, plus whoever pays for 12 hours of training. So that's one leg of the requirement. As a bartender, you may also be handling ice and other condiments, and so you need a county health department license, which requires approximately 2 hours of training and $10 fee. As an OLCC server, you need a $23 application to the state of Oregon, a license that's good for 5 years. You also need to pay for the class, which is a 4 or 5 hour class, or you may take it online, and that's a $25 fee. Suddenly, with a few departments within the state of Oregon, and in order to get a minimum wage paying job that may have tips or may not, is a $300, $400, $500, $600 investment per employee, depending on whether you're paying them to go to 12 hours of training, take the health department test, and go to an OLCC license or get your service permit. That's how I see it from the field. The example I'd like to use as to the clarification on this Senate bill is I provide alcohol service to Oregon State University for their home football games. While the entire city is walking the sidewalks carrying a beer to and from the football game, I try to control the premise at the Alumni Association. We have patios around the Alumni Association, which begins our licensed area. The access to that area, I put an alcohol monitor at, who asks the public, they ask the public not to bring your own beer into the alumni. And we ask that the beer we serve them in the Alumni Association does not leave the licensed area. That position, I thought, and have always applied to be an alcohol management position. DPSST does not. They view it as controlling access. Therefore, each alcohol monitor needs to be DPSST certified. And the brush that they use to apply is that we are controlling access. We don't check their ID. We only ask that they keep their own beer outside, and we ask them to keep my beer inside. That's what that position is. The citation that I was issued by DPSST is I had four people on four different doors. Each citation is $1,000, and then I must have all of them in compliance. So that's the situation. I ask that you consider amending this, which will help some of the language, and approve Senate Bill 878. I'm available for any questions.
So DPSST issued or OLCC?
DPSST.
Okay. Thank you.
Can members, any questions?
I just want to make sure I understand, Mr. Moran. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you were fined, you had four people working in the perimeter, and you were fined $1,000 for each of those because they weren't licensed by DPSST?
That is correct.
Thank you.
Jim, do you know where the dollars go? Do you know where the money goes from the fines?
I do not know that for sure.
Okay, we'll check and find out where that is going, and I want to get the total, too, if we can, that they receive statewide from that activity. Any further questions? Okay, thank you. And we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 878, and I think we're done for the day.
Okay.